This podcast is sponsored by Hover, the best way to buy and manage domain names. Please visit hover.com and use promo code CastleBlack to get 10% off your first order.
Has to pay the iron price. Has to pay the iron price.
I'll never respect you while he lives.
Watch it all come around as I lay on the ground. Joffrey, Cersei, Illyn Payne, and Hound. They all think I'm lost, but I know where I'm bound. I'm the blood in the north when it all comes down. My word is my bond, and my bond is my word. Valar Dohaeris, all men must serve. See, as a raven flies, and time slips by. Valar Morghulis, all men must die.
Welcome to the Game of Thrones podcast brought to you by BaldMove.com. We are the officially unofficial podcast for HBO's Game of Thrones television series. I'm your host, Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
And tonight we're going to be talking about episode 9 of season 4, The Watchers on the Wall.
Seriously watching from that wall.
They are watching hard. They're doing more than watching. They're shooting. They're dropping. They're scything.
Uh-huh.
They're defending. They're standing. They're holding.
They're knocking. Dying. They're drawing.
They're swapping sex talk, sexy sex talk, locker room talking.
Yeah.
Lots of stuff all on the wall, all along this watchtower. This is directed by Neil Marshall, last heard from in season 2, episode 9, Blackwater.
Seriously? It's the same guy who did this episode.
Apparently they bring this guy out when big guns are needed.
I guess so.
We've got a sprawling battle fought in one location. Neil, do you got anything going on that weekend? All right, head on to Estonia or Iceland or bumfuck Sweden, wherever we're filming these wall scenes.
But Blackwater felt like the 50 cal that's mounted to the back of the truck. This felt like the AK that just got dropped in the dirt.
Okay.
I mean, it's not that bad. It's not bad. No.
You're going to get people pissed at
I know,
us.
Already. I'll explain that in further detail later.
Can you please? David Benioff and D.B. Weiss, of course, wrote, as they do most of the episodes, and this premiered to 6.95 million people watching, which is down about a quarter mil of butthurt Oberon weepers could not make it this week.
That's a lot of people.
Yeah. No,
quarter million?
It goes up and down. I mean, it's highly unusual for a show to gain watchers as it goes. It
yes,
almost
definitely.
Never happens.
Sometimes it'll happen in the season finale.
Yeah.
But that's about it.
But usually shows lose viewers season by season and episode by episode. And
yep.
This defies all trends. So let's talk about this episode. Shall we talk about our overall opinion? I think you kind of spoiled it. We talked about it on the Instant Cast that this is not a bad episode. Everybody settle down.
No, this was a fairly strong episode. It was certainly epic, but it was not Blackwater. Come on, people.
No, that's the thing. I don't think people can make an argument, at least none that's compelling to me, that say this is as epic as Blackwater, or that it was as personally tragic as Ned or the Red Wedding. I just don't think you can make those types of arguments, and that's
sure.
It's competition.
Yeah, yeah. I
In
mean,
fact,
within the same show.
Its competition this season has been deaths of Joffrey, Sack of Meereen.
The explosion
death of
Oberyn's head was
yes.
incredible.
Yes.
And the stuff, I mean, even the courtroom scene with Tyrion had more of an emotional punch than Jon losing Ygritte. I didn't give a shit about Ygritte.
Yeah, a lot of people did. I honestly found it hard to engage with their relationship both in the books and on screen.
Okay.
Feel like, you know, Rose gave it as good as she got. I feel like that, you know, Kit Harington has definitely grown a lot as an actor.
Oh yeah. And a character, Jon Snow.
And as a character. But in the end, we, you know, if it's competing against Blackwater for spectacle, it's hard to beat that wildfire and, you know, the desperate defense of the wall and the stakes and the fact that, you know, is Tyrion leading the charge, and it's just, you know, Tyrion and the Hound versus Jon and Ed.
And Sam.
It's just, yeah, and Sam there, and, you know, Alistair Thorne. I mean, Jonas
yeah.
Slint. It's not the same.
Because I don't hate Alistair Thorne nearly as much as I hated Joffrey at that point. So when Joffrey chickened out and couldn't, you know, bolster his forces, I did not have a problem with that. I enjoyed seeing that.
Right.
Alistair Thorne kind of was somewhere in the middle. He definitely helped the battle. He did
sure.
his fair share and fought. And I don't know. I just didn't feel the punch that I felt during Blackwater.
Well, let's talk about it. Before we get started, I want to talk about something me and Jim are pretty excited about and only tangentially talks or touches on Game of Thrones, so I'm going to keep it brief. So Breaking Bad fans, Miguel and Jenny, living out in the Albuquerque in the ABQ, are doing a Breaking Bad festival that's coming up in the autumn. They have a Facebook page where you can get all the information right now. It's facebook.com/BreakingBadFest. And they have a Kickstarter that's going live tonight. And if you are a fan and you're interested in going to this, go and check it out. They've got a really cool pitch video. It's got, who was it? Was it Victor?
Yeah, Victor and, he's in it.
Victor from Breaking Bad is in it. And they're going to have a panel. It's going to be a two-day fest. They're going to have a panel with several stars of Breaking Bad that they've invited Jim and I out there to moderate. We're going to be at the con meeting and greeting and emceeing some events. They're going to have a costume show. They're going to have a lot of tours organized where you can actually go out and see Tahaja Lee and the spillway where Jesse and Walt got picked up by the cleaners. And, I'm getting a little bit of spoiler reaction. it's going to be a really good time. And if you've ever thought about making a pilgrimage out to Albuquerque to see some of these locations and meet some of the stars, it's going to be as big as the fans support it. They've got in mind a budget and basically whatever the Kickstarter breaks in, it's going to go right to the convention and make it bigger, better. So how big will it get? Not really sure until the Kickstarter is over, but Jim and I wanted to throw our support behind that because we're big Breaking Bad fans and we're excited to be a part of this. So check out facebook.com/BreakingBadFest. Click through there to the Kickstarter and support them for as much as you can.
Here are the weekly highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Apple TV is releasing a new series based on Blake Crouch's novel Dark Matter. Aaron and I are big fans of his work, so we're picking up the new show on day one. Join us this Wednesday for the preview podcast.
The Shogun Limited series might be over, but that doesn't mean our Shogun coverage has to end. We've got the wrap-up podcast releasing this Tuesday, where we'll consider all your feedback and final thoughts on the series. And because we like the show so much, we decided to go all the way back to 1980 to cover the first TV adaptation of the novel. Do what you can to find a copy and join us this Thursday for the first of our four-part podcast on 1980 Shogun miniseries.
And finally, the latest first-run movie, The Fall Guy, features Emily Blunt and Ryan Gosling. He's a stuntman tasked with finding the star of his ex-girlfriend's movie when he suddenly goes missing. Is it a rom-com? Yes. Does that mean I'll automatically hate it? Not if the trailer lives up to its promise. Join us for the podcast on Bald Move Pulp this Thursday night.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
Without further ado, we'll get to the Game of Thrones part of the episode. It's the night, the calm before the storm. Mm-hmm. It's the night of the battle, actually. And John and Sam are on the wall. And Sam wants to know what's it like to be with a woman, basically.
Sure.
And John is poorly equipped to describe what it's like in any capacity. You know, and
she had red hair. What did her feet look like?
I thought that was pretty funny.
That was good, yeah.
You know what's disturbing? Like, if you Google for an actress's name, one of the top five autocompletes on damn near everyone is feet.
Okay.
There is a lot of people Googling for actresses' feet. And you know, maybe foot fetish is like a vastly more popular fetish in the American culture than I would get than I would grant it. And there's nothing wrong with that.
I totally don't understand it, though.
I'm just thinking that there's enough people that that's like the top five search results for a lot of actresses that you would search for. Anyway, they also talk about how the Night's Watch vows are slightly open to interpretation.
Mm-hmm.
Got a hole that you can drive a fairly big horse cart through. You can't father children, and you can't have wives. But there's nothing to say, you know, there's no Night's Watch vow that says, I shall have no mouth on my wang.
No, no.
I shall accept no hand job.
I shall give no hand job.
I shall.
Nothing in that.
That's right.
Goes both ways, man.
Yeah, that's right. I shall not welcome my brother into my anal cavity. Nah, I mean, there's exceptions. There's ways to work within those rules.
Definitely, yeah.
I shall not pull out and wait. You know, there's nothing about that. So there's a lot of wiggle room there.
Mm-hmm. But and I think Sam's also right in that Alistair would not interpret that favorably for John.
See, that's bullshit. Because, and that's the thing, it's an open secret that many a black brother go off to wiggle in Molestown.
Sure.
And nobody really gets punished for that.
But John would, because Alistair fucking hates him.
Would he? I don't know.
Not at this moment, not while the wall is under siege, but certainly before or after, yeah.
The thing is, I feel like people's a little... Alistair is an asshole. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to debate that. But he's also the drill sergeant. He's kind of supposed to be an asshole. And John did kill one of the most famous Rangers in Night's Watch history, and freely admitting to sleeping with a wildling girl. That is a little fishy. Okay. Not to mention he's a bastard, and they're just no good.
Sure.
No good bastards.
Everyone on the wall is a no good bastard.
Pretty much. So we then see a war gal on top of the wall, and that is a segue to us then being inside the wildling camp, where Tormund Giantsbane's trying to talk about the time he fucked a bear.
Mm-hmm.
And Ygritte doesn't want any of it. She wants them all focused up and know that the ginger men just claiming Jon Snow.
Yeah,
I killed him, and if I didn't kill him, none of you kill him, because I'm going to kill him faster.
Sure.
And that's about all for the scene. Except for we see, it's kind of weird, we see it pans up onto the ridge and we see Gilly with her baby just creeping along there and on her way to Castle Black. Which I get the opinion is wildling camp is happening literally right outside the gates.
Seems like it. Yeah.
Like a quarter mile away, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Enough time for Sam to go talk with Master Aemon.
Right.
Or Maester Aemon, sorry.
So he goes to talk to Maester Aemon because John sent him to go to bed, and he refuses to because apparently he's up and he's trying to read about wildling raids on villages to try to find comfort. I guess he's looking for instances where they may have spared women and children, or who the hell knows. He's just up reading. And they talk about, love being the death of duty, and the fact that Sam loves Gilly, and then Maester Aemon talks about him loving a girl once. It's good acting material, but does it mean anything to the larger story?
It does. It solidifies Sam's conviction once Gilly comes back. I mean, without that discussion, I don't know that Sam kind of has the balls that he does during the battle.
Mm. Okay. In fact, we go on, and as he's going to presumably his bed, because Maester Aemon kicks him out of the library, he finds Pip is arguing with a girl outside the door. Turns out it's Gilly with the baby, and he's like, "Open a fucking gate, Pip." And he does so, and he promises her that anyone that tries to throw her out of Castle Black from here on out are going to have words with me. Sure. There's 100,000 wildlings about ready to throw her out of Castle Black, so...
They're all going to have a word with Sam.
And he's got a hearty fucking for each one of them.
Yeah.
Stay the fuck out of our gates. Mance then lives up to his word that he's going to light the largest fire the North's ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly, saw Craster's keep fire and said, "That's not a fire. This is a fire."
Yeah, I'll show them a fire.
Sets damn near the entire haunted forest on fire.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know that you needed a war gal to tell you that the fire, it's time, because the entire northern skyline was orange with this fucking fire.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I didn't even realize that that's what the war gal was for. I thought it was counting their numbers.
I think it's for both, honestly, because they had instant, like how many were up top versus how many were below. And
yeah.
And then the wildlings were confident that they could then go up and over the outer walls of Castle Black.
Oh, God.
Before they...
what a terrible idea.
What's a terrible idea?
Going up the wall. What a horrible idea.
What else are they supposed to do?
Just concentrate on that freaking tunnel?
No, I'm talking about the guys on the southern side of the wall.
Oh, yeah. They'll use the elevator to get up, sure.
Sure. There's a surprising amount of confusion about what the wall looks like, and mm-hmm. probably a lot of it stemming from the stylized way in which they choose to depict the wall on the map.
In the intro, yeah. So this, I was confused, too.
Yeah, this wall is something, like in the book they talk about 700 feet high. I've heard that is just absurdly high. And that George R. R. Martin has a hard time with scale when he's, like, thinking about it.
It looks about 700 feet high,
I read that the FX guys say that it's somewhere between 400 and 500 feet tall.
Okay. That's a fairly small distinction. Like, sure. How hard is a 500-foot wall to cross versus a 700-foot wall?
400, so it's like roughly half the size, and it's still fucking immense. Can you imagine if it's 700 feet tall? It'd be ridiculous.
Yeah. So, but on the map in the intro, it looks like it's about 50 miles thick.
And it looks kind of like glacier a little, or the fact that it, like, yeah. Some people were confused that it was, they thought it maybe was like a canyon kind of thing. Where the wall is kind of like you hear the continental shelf described in the ocean, where you kind of got this plane and it just drops off and then there's another plane.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't think people understood that the wall is a literal wall built out of ice, and it's protects the north and the south and vice versa, sure.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and you kind of got that. In the books, they talk about how 12 mounted knights can ride abreast on the top of the wall, and the bottom is roughly twice as thick. So you can kind of do some math. And I thought it was interesting to see how the brothers have carved like crenulations at the top and like defensive embankments. And they've got tunnels to go take you out of the weather. And you can board that little weird gate bucket thing. But just I think that there's a scene in here that we're about to get to that kind of shows you what the geography is all about. We see Alistair Thorne defending his leadership choices.
I like this scene a lot.
Yeah.
I got to say.
Yeah. What did you like about it?
I like the fact that despite the animosity between Alistair and John, Alistair is on John's side at this point. And he comes to him and basically apologizes. He says, yeah, I was a dick, but if I were not sure of my convictions at that point, then you could have seen me as weak and I would have lost my way and this whole thing could have fallen apart. I mean, he sees himself as the leader of this group of people and he needs to be that. And if that means being a dick to somebody, then so be it.
Right. Again, I think he can be understood properly through the lens of a drill sergeant.
Yes, I agree.
And, you know, he finds a way to motivate. And he's got seventh sons and horse thieves and rapists that he's working with, and he's got to kind of like break these guys down, form them. It's kind of surprising they fight as effectively as they do. Like, it does seem that by the end of their induction process, when they take their vows, that they've been more or less melded into a fighting unit.
Yeah,
mutineers up at Craster's Keep to the you know, but that was only six or seven guys versus you know, 100 or more that went up on the Great Ranging. So
what happens if you wash out of the Night's Watch training program?
That's a good question. I guess it depends on
you're
where
you're there as a punishment almost always.
I was gonna say it depends on why you're there. If you're like a second son and went and said, "Dad, this is I can't take the vows," you could probably always go back, because I think it's once you take the vows you're fucked.
Okay.
But if you're a criminal and you're sent there in lieu of...
You're probably punished how you would have been punished had you not gone to the wall, right?
But they do that at the wall. It's like, okay, well, you were going to lose your right hand, so right hand's off, get the fuck out. Do they ship you back down south? Is it more like one of those...
Nothing about this in the books, or is it spoilery, or...
No.
Nothing about it?
There's not really a case where that particular situation happens. It's something that John thinks a lot about.
Okay.
But no, I can't think of an instance where that's actually addressed. I wonder if it's kind of like, I'm a big fan of the Patrick O'Brien Age of Sail, like set in the Napoleonic Wars, British sailing fiction.
Master and Commander.
And they'd have, you know, you'd just get impressed. Like, you'd be walking down the city and a press gang would come, and if you were the right size and age and shape, they'd just snatch you off the street, throw you on the boat. And that would be it, you know?
The visual draft.
Yes. but they also would, like, for the less... Because the smart people would hide. They'd know the press gang's coming. But for the real idiots, they'd actually have, like, signs like, come up, you know, adventure, and you can save prize money and do all these things. Just
Wait. They still do that.
Wait.
To enlist people.
No. I haven't gotten to the part.
Okay.
It's like, come aboard to inquire. You come aboard,
set sail.
Regardless of your response to the sales pitch,
oh god,
you're either going onto the boat, you're not getting off that boat.
Okay, they don't do that anymore.
Yeah. You can't like show up at a recruiter's office, get clapped in irons, and like you wake up here in the Gulf of Arabia. You know, that doesn't happen. They do some other bullshit stuff, sure, but
sure.
anyway, I imagine it's like that with the Night's Watch. It's like, you know, it's like, well, I'd just rather lose my right hand than, you know, the guy look at you like, well, I wish I wasn't, you know, born the first son and inherited my daddy's castle, and that's not going to happen. So stuck at the wall, boy. Or they just kill you. Like, I just feel like the Night's Watch doesn't have enough men to ship you down or do any of that bullshit.
Yeah, yeah, so they'll discard you. The other thing I noticed about Allison...
That's my head canon. There's no canon source. That's just what I imagine happens.
Okay, sure. The other thing that I noticed about Alistair Thorne in this episode, and this particular scene, is he has the largest face-to-head ratio, or vice versa. His face is tiny compared to his head.
He's an odd-looking dude.
His eyes are very close together. His mouth is close to his nose.
He looks like he's wearing guyliner, although I don't think he is.
And I'm not making fun of the man. I'm just saying it's, I noticed it. It's noticeable.
Yeah. No, I get what
you're
saying.
Nothing wrong with having a small face and a gigantic head.
Who's the guy that played Whiplash in the second Iron Man? He's also in the second Expendables.
Mickey Rourke.
He's got a Mickey Rourke face. Where this guy was a really good-looking dude once upon a time, and maybe there's some questionable decisions made with steroids. Maybe like it's just the ravages of time.
Okay.
He's just gotten the, like, his, you know, bloated old guy face that's had a couple glasses of scotch a day.
Sure. Like every person on the planet will be if they live to old age.
Certainly. I feel like, yeah, he's got some interesting things. That face has got some interesting miles.
Okay.
That's all I'm saying.
Sure.
Where the fuck were we? My last point in my notes said guyliner. Oh, yes. Gilly's upset that Sam takes her down into some sort of secure storeroom, buried deep at Castle Black, or maybe even underneath the wall. He says, you'll be safe for now here. And then he goes to leave, and she's all pissed. Like, you can't leave me. And he goes, that's what men do, baby. Grabs her for a kiss. He promises her that he'll never die.
Well, okay. So we like to get a little hyperbolic and say that he promises he'll never die. What he promises is that he won't die before he sees her again, really, right?
Yeah, but that's still not a promise you can make with...
It's... Certainly not. And
he takes the wrong giant's arrow, and he's a dead man before he even hits the ground. I mean,
yeah. There's nothing he can do to carry out that promise. That's the problem I have with the very end of this scene, is the promise he makes, because he has just told her how important these promises and vows are to him. Mm. I will not break my oath. I will stay here and I will fight with my brothers. But I'll promise you also something that I can't possibly guarantee.
Man, people do that all the fucking time, though. Marriage is a similar promise. I'll just go out and say,
I know, but
I promise I will always leave you and I'll never leave you. Meanwhile, what's the divorce rate in this country?
Sure.
Like 50%?
I'm saying you don't come from telling someone how important your promises are to making a promise you know you can't keep. And they know you can't keep.
But I think that's the thing. It's kind of like just the tip, baby.
Oh, Jesus.
To the extent that that works on anyone, to the extent that that's a real thing that happens, that both parties have to know that it's a bullshit pretext, and they both have to want, both people, it's like, you know, if you let a man put the tip of your penis inside your vagina or anus, if you're another man, that's the understanding that it's
or
not.
Or your nose.
It's or your nose, your ear canal.
Sure, yeah.
A little shinshi,
I think you're a little narrow-minded in your sexual views, Aaron.
I just broadened it. I just wrenched my mind open. But I feel like that both parties kind of go in knowing that it's not going to be just a tip, right?
I want to put a disclaimer on this. I'm not totally certain that I agree with you here.
The just a tip is a farce. It's. I can't believe
it. Clearly is.
I can't believe there's men that use it. I can't believe there's women that believe it. And I feel like that must be. It's like, you know, if you're a nice girl and you want to have sex because that's the way women are. They want to have sex. Surprise, surprise.
What?
But you're raised in a society where the patriarchy and other things have taught you that that's bad. You both kind of need this emotional fig leaf to proceed with things. And maybe that's kind of like this type of lie that, like, okay, well, if it's what you want to hear, it's what I want to believe. And if it doesn't come true, well, I'm dead.
Then it doesn't matter. Yeah.
And it doesn't matter.
Or at least to him, it'll definitely matter to her.
Right.
That's the thing. He's also putting all of this baggage on her. Like, if he dies out there after promising he won't die, well, he broke his promise and she has to blame herself somewhat for letting him go, and like there's a lot of shit that she's gonna have to deal with if he doesn't come back.
Not to mention the you know, eventual 100,000 wildings that you think are going to come pouring through.
There's that, yeah.
Because it doesn't seem like there's anything the Black Brothers can do to keep this going for maybe another night, maybe another two.
I don't know. Their only weakness, the only weakness here is that tunnel, right? I mean, if they had sealed that tunnel, there is no way this army gets across that wall.
But it's too late to seal the tunnel.
It is too late, yes. So now it feels like they need to leave a couple of dudes with some big boots up on the wall so that when these guys try to climb it stupidly, they can just put the boot on their face and kick them back down the wall. Like, this is the easiest thing to defend,
but
right?
But there are people dying every night. Now, probably, you know, now that they've got this one invasion from the south beat back, it won't be as many people dying. But it's clearly a war of attrition.
They just need to protect that tunnel.
Well, but then, I think that's short-sighted. Because, like, if Mance, like, on phase two of the invasion, he can send 1,000 guys a mile up the wall this way and a mile up the wall that way. You all climb it, and then you cut meet like a hammer and an anvil in the middle and just make salsa out of the Black Brothers.
Sure. No, he needs to do that. He needs to use some fucking tactics.
I'm saying there's nothing.
The way he did it this time was dumb.
Yeah, but it's a probing action. And it almost worked.
You know, I can waste 1,000 guys. Not a problem. Let's just throw a grand worth of troops at the wall.
We're getting ahead of ourselves slightly.
We are.
Pip and Sam talk about courage, because we know Sam's famously a coward, but he did manage to kill the White Walker. And what do you think of his rationale behind that?
Him being nothing, having nothing to lose, and so...
That in the moment, you know, it's like, what else are you going to do? You can either curl up and piss yourself and die anyway, or you can find whatever it is inside yourself that... You know, the essential truth that none of us are anything. We're all just a film of dust on a film of dust on a fucking rock hurling through space. So what does it matter anyway? Might as well take a piss and stick this piece of glass in a White Walker. Sometimes magic happens.
Yeah, well,
Sam said, just the tip, White Walker.
This the tip.
It won't
of this
go any
glass.
Further. with tragic results.
What is his friend's name here? The one who gets shot through the neck with an arrow?
Pip.
Pip. So he tells Pip this story about the White Walker and killing it, and his reason for going after it is because it was attacking Gilly, and if she was gone, he had nothing.
Right.
He was nothing.
Right.
And that very much plays into how he acts once she comes back. It felt like that steeled him for this battle.
Okay. Yeah, it does seem like he's talking on both sides of his mouth, or maybe it's a different type of courage. There's the fight or flight courage, and then there's the now I have something to protect. I'm going this with my eyes wide open, sober type of courage.
Sure, he had something to protect in both instances, the same thing, but he did it for differently each time.
At any rate, now is the time the wildlings decide it's right to attack the ones from the south. And they start screaming and heading over. Yeah. Up on the wall, we see the wildlings are starting to assault from... They're starting to approach, and Alistair gives them a little taste of some flaming arrow. It doesn't do much but kill a few of them. But then they hear a second horn, and they realize there's attack coming from the south. And I think this shot is key to understanding geography of the battle, because they do this kind of like swooping crane shot where it falls off the edge of the wall and goes all the way to the bottom, and you can see Castle Black. There's a lot of emails because, you know, their opinions are divided about whether you enjoyed this episode. And I don't think anyone hated it, but there's a lot of nitpicking, more so than normal. And one of the common nitpicks were, why the fuck do you have such an obvious weak point? This castle is not designed to withstand an attack from the south. That's actually a historical fact.
That makes sense, yeah.
That that in the mists of time, a couple of the Black Brothers got a little too big for the britches and became like kings unto their own right with this massive military force they had up here.
Mm-hmm.
And they used to have more impressive southern fortifications, but that actually worked. So when the lords of Westeros went to wage war against the Night's Watch and put this rebellion down, it's like, this is bullshit. We're fighting our own men and all this. So from that point on, it became customary for the Night's Watch not to be allowed to set up heavy fortifications. They have castles, but with very little outer walls and defensive, I mean, it's just rudimentary.
Yeah, that's no King's Landing for sure.
It's no, so it definitely bites them in the ass here, because it's just not designed to withstand an attack from the south.
And that makes sense, right? Conceivably, the whole reason they built it was to protect against things from the north.
Exactly.
Coming down to the south.
So you can't slight him from that. So anyway, Alistair sees that and says, holy shit, I gotta get down there, because anybody can say knock, draw, and hold and release.
Yep.
Gives that job to Janna Slint, goes on down and gives this 100 generations to defend this castle. I promise you, if you fight, that it will be standing tomorrow. And goes into ass-kicking mode.
Yeah, maybe lets his speech go on a little long. Lets a bunch of guys get in through this tiny hole they could easily defend.
Right.
But, you know, yeah. so it is. You got to give the people a proper motivation.
With me now, now with me. At the present time, you should be with me. In the future as well.
Here they come, boss. Should we do anything? You are with me, are you not?
That's right. Yeah, it's several different ways to say that. I thought it was a pretty impressive speech, and he backs it up, you know? And yes. I think that's what the Night's Watch responds to, strength.
A lot of badass stuff in this episode, no doubt. And Alistair is one of them.
Speaking of badass stuff, the mammoths and the giants swing into action. These mammoths ride giant, or the mammoths ride the giants. They take turns. They flip the coin. It's the mammoth's turn to be rid today. So the giant is riding on the mammoth. But it doesn't look like it's, you know, I mean, that mammoth looks like a large dog compared to the giant.
Oh, gotcha. Like if you were to ride a donkey or something. Like
the giant could just get up
on
his tippy toe and the mammoth could just sidle up right underneath him.
Yeah, kind of.
They're both just huge things.
Sure. Before we get too far away from this, I wanted to say one thing they did that was kind of, I guess, foreshadowing for Ygritte not wanting to kill John when she had the chance, is that when they say, let's go have some crow or eat crow or whatever they say when they get ready to attack, she's got a look on her face. Like, she's not totally sure she wants to do this, because maybe she doesn't know if she can kill John if she finds him. That was kind of my take on it.
Oh, totally. No, she's a conflicted woman.
But they make a point of showing that.
And it ends up killing her, too.
Yeah. Yeah.
In fact, there's this one point, and I stopped taking really detailed notes and just started writing highlights because...
For the battle.
Yeah. There's this one point in a battle where it seems like a Jon Snow lookalike. A black brother, not quite as dreamy, but nearly as dreamy as Kit Harington, wanders into her sights, and she kind of briefly hesitated there, too.
Oh.
So I thought that was another foreshadowing that there's going to be some problems. Uh-huh. Anyway, the mammoths swing into action, and two giants and a mammoth come up. They hook up their... big rope and iron hooks to the cold rolled steel. Mm-hmm. I've gave him very small chance of success, because I don't feel like you can pull down something that's 4 inches steel thick with like a half inch steel hook.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
you need something a size appropriate for the job, giant man.
I don't know.
Maybe some
on...
chains instead of some half frozen hemp rope would be called for.
Maybe. Well, it's clear that they didn't even have enough strength to break that rope, so they're not getting through the wall, through the gate.
Yeah, and again, it's like, I guess the things are disappointing in when I see this is, I just feel like it wouldn't, so they're rendering all this stuff as all CG, or the most of it, it's all composited. Would it kill them to have like some kind of siege work that they pushed up to the wall? Because they had to have, like, there's just arrows pouring down and raining down. But you'll notice that when the giants are down there at the gates fucking around, there's hardly anything. There's, like, maybe three flaming arrows to hit. There should be a hail of stuff. And they eventually drop the barrels and stuff. But I'm thinking these guys should have never been able to get to the wall. There's only, 12 dudes, a mammoth, and 2 giants.
Yeah.
They should not have been able to get to the wall being pelted with all the shit that the Night's Watch could pelt them with.
Yeah, I imagine it's pretty hard to hit somebody looking down 500 feet, though.
I don't know. On the other hand, you can just drop things off in a bee leaf. Like, I don't even know they needed to have the guys winched out standing against the wall with the arrows. You could just, drop an arrow down, and it's going to do lethal damage when it hits.
Yeah, or rocks, if you're trying to knock guys off a wall.
But if they got a mammoth, why wouldn't they, tow some big kind of, wooden shed that they could push up against the gate that would believably... buy them protection from some of the shit. The fact that they didn't even try, and I know it was just a probing action, and whatever, Mance didn't expect to break through on this round, but, the giant was strong enough to lift up the gate. What if they had teams that had something that they could just prop, two by fours or something they could prop underneath the gate? And
two by fours, yeah. under the 4 inches of cold rolled steel.
Wood's compression resistance is quite impressive. Maybe not 2x4, but okay. 4x4 post.
There you go.
The Giants could have like grabbed the log or jammed it up there. I mean, I just feels like that's the kind of thing that's bugging me. It's like all nitpicky stuff where I'm like, I just don't understand why they would assault the wall. Why would they bother trying to climb the wall?
Climbing the wall is the most insane thing, because even if you make it to the top,
what are you going to do?
You're going to be jello. Your arms are going to be loose leaf tea just flailing in the wind.
Right. You're going to climb a 400-foot high ice wall and then do battle at the top.
Not going to happen.
And if you wanted to do that plan, the plan would have been to send them a couple hours ago so they all – and maybe that's the point that Janice was trying to make. These are undisciplined and unorganized and they're wildlings and all that stuff. But their commander's not. Commander's not an idiot. He's one of the Black Brothers. He would know how to hit these guys the best anyway.
Yeah.
So it's like, yes, it was epic, but could it have been more epic? Could it have been more believably epic?
I mean, they're going to take it more epic. They've got to take it more epic either next episode or early next season. One of the two. I don't know which they're going to go with, but they've got to. I mean, they have 100,000 troops out there. There's no way this doesn't get more epic.
So the epic stuff, like the giant firing his arrow, was
fucking awesome.
Really fucking cool.
Yeah.
And I like seeing that. I like the brutality of the fight, the eye gouging and screaming that's happening below. That mean it feels like medieval combat. Ygritte is a total badass. She is straight up murdering fools. I mean, I would say that she's probably right, that she has the highest body count of any of them going this battle. She's just like every half second killing some guy.
Sure.
I loved when they stormed the Night's Watch mess hall, that the cooks were there with their boiling water and their fucking meat cleavers.
Taking heads off. Right.
And Pip gets to finally make a kill right before and kind of triumph a little bit. And Sam had a funny thing. It was like, oh, is the battle over? And Pip's like, no. It's like, well then. And he reloads a crossbow, hand it to him, gets shot in the throat. And him and Sam have a nice little moment. I mean, this probably means a lot more to book readers than it does to show watchers. It
meant almost nothing to me.
Grin, who's the big, tall, bearded dude that holds the gates, and Pip, who's the guy who gets shot through the throats, they're like, you know, they're the guys that got inducted to John. They've been through a lot together. They're a lot more fleshed out, realized characters. And also, point of fact, they're still alive in the books, so it's rather shocking to see these big names get kind of slaughtered here.
Yeah.
In the name of amping up the emotion of the battle. So, what else we're going to talk about this?
With, what do you mean this? Like the battle in general?
I'm just trying to get my bearings about where we are in the battle. Like right now, the Giants have got their cable system deployed.
Then the Giant gets killed, one of them.
It doesn't look like they got the shit to actually get that job done. Mm-hmm. John sends Grin below to defend the inner gates because he knows how important that is. I guess John's writing off the outer gates and saying, you know, we got to get to the inner gates to defend. Mm-hmm. Alistair and Tormund Giantsbane kind of have a mini epic fight here in the middle of the battle. That was really well choreographed. Mm-hmm. You could tell that, like, Sir Alistair is slightly better trained, has slightly better like footwork and movement, but Tormund is just a beast.
Yeah.
And he's hard to deal with. Gets his groin cut and has to fall back. Sam goes back up to speak with John. He also gives a little pep talk with Ollie, who's the little kid that his parents got slaughtered in the village, and he's the best bowman in his village. Mm-hmm. Says, you got to get up and fight, Ollie, which then condemns Ygritte to death. Stop me if you get to anything here. We got flaming oil drums that get dropped. You know, first we had barrels full of rocks, and those things went off like bombs after being dropped from such a height. Now we got, basically Molotov barrel tails being dropped off. One of them explodes on the wall and kills God knows how many Black Brothers.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's bad news. The other one blasts off right next to a giant. Giant doesn't care.
Yeah. Giants are the honey badgers of the north. They just don't give a shit.
Yeah, I was surprised to see how much damage a giant can take. I don't know that you could kill a giant with human-sized arrows.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point. I think later on in the battle, when one of them is breached and is heading towards the inner gate, they mentioned that you could stick with 20 arrows. Or maybe they said he had been stuck with 20 arrows and it made no difference.
Yeah, maybe so.
I buy that. One of those big jobs, which I think they call a scorpion. It's like the big winch-mounted crossbows that throw spears from the top of the wall. Huh. Manages to impale one, and that sends the other into a fucking rage.
Yeah, he goes for the door.
In the books, the guy that breaches the wall is named Mag the Mighty, and he's kind of one of the biggest, strongest, toughest elders of the giants. And he goes on a rampage, similarly like he does here on the screen. At this point, John says, tells his friend Ed, Dolores Ed, that you have the wall, and to keep dropping stones, and he mentions a scythe to them, too. We then go below into the middle of the ice wall where Grin is preparing his troops for the last stand. They, you know, it's a pretty stirring scene where they recite the Night's Watch oath as a single angry giant is smashing through the gates.
That was fairly badass. I thought, like, the entire time I was watching that the first time, I was like, shoot some arrows, do something.
Yeah.
Like, you see him coming, hurt him. Then I kind of got to thinking about it. You probably can't hurt him that bad from outside the thing. And it was kind of badass that they were psyching themselves up like that. I like where it cut away. Really good scene. Really good scene.
I've got some criticisms of this scene as well, but there's a reader that has a really excellent breakdown. I'm going to save that till the feedback section.
Okay.
But anyway, that's Grin's last stand. We see as John and Sam and a couple other black brothers are descending in the big basket, he gives Sam a key to go sell. Which is going to, you know, the direwolf gets loose and he just basically takes out a single fin.
Yeah, pretty much.
He's like, you know, I haven't been fed in like 3 days, so if you don't mind, boss, I'm going to tear this guy's throat out and eat some entrails.
Yeah.
Still haven't seen a direwolf just rampage.
Yeah, that wasn't a rampage.
I want to see some Shinobi 2 style action where just these wolves are just plowing through things.
I do like the thin commander or leader. I don't know what to call him. But he is pretty badass, the one who fights with John.
Yeah. I think in the books he's called Steer or Magnar or something like that.
Hmm. Okay.
Yeah, no, he's a massive dude, number one.
Yeah.
Just a really big dude, and he's fighting with like a cross between a giant morning star and a double-bladed two-handed great axe.
Yeah.
And again, it's kind of like a similar Tormund to you know, versus Sir Alistair, John versus this thin guy.
Mm-hmm.
And I liked a couple other things, like the fact that John just can't wait to get into the fight. Like, they're still 10 feet off the ground, and he does this kind of like commando roll and comes up like the Tasmanian devil with the Valyrian steel blade in his arms.
Sure. I think he knows he's the best fighter there and that these guys really need him.
Sure. And they go into this kind of true detective money / brag shot where it's a good 60 second single take whirling all around, showing off the fact that this is a real set with real people. I mean, I'm sure they did a lot of digital compositing and stuff, but it looked like $1 million. It probably cost 10 times that much.
Probably. Yeah. It was badass. A lot of badass stuff in this.
Out of all the single tracking shots we've seen in these seasons, who did the best one? True Detective, Fargo, or Game of Thrones?
True Detective, without a doubt.
Why?
It was the first one I saw, for one, which makes it automatically more impressive. It was technically more impressive. In this one, all they do is kind of spin the camera in the middle of this open courtyard.
Mm-hmm.
With True Detective, they go inside of houses. There's a lot more going on around him.
Oh, yeah. It's basically a running battle through a neighborhood.
Yeah.
And it sticks with them for like 4 minutes. Maybe five.
Into houses, into yards, into other houses, around fences. Like,
the degree of difficulty was pretty high for that shot.
Without a doubt. And then the Fargo tracking shot was just, you know, very, like, really, really easy to pull off.
Yeah.
So technically very unimpressive, but stylistically very impressive.
Yeah, I'd probably rate him True Detective, Game of Thrones, Fargo.
Probably, yeah.
On difficulty and probably artistic. Maybe Fargo above Game of Thrones for artistic.
Yeah, maybe so.
So we got that. The brutal fight between John and Thin. Another problem with that, if you show your star getting his teeth bounced into a blacksmith's anvil, he better not have nice, white, straight, shiny teeth the next time I see him.
Trouble is, you then lose your Game of Thrones heartthrob. Who are the ladies going to root for if Jon Snow has no teeth?
I get that, but I feel like then don't show his head getting bounced into a steel immovable object.
I'm with you.
There's a lot of ways you can inflict pain other than that, because I gotta, you know, it'd be like someone gets their nose cut off and the next scene their nose is back. That's bullshit, man. This guy's like, like we said, if the mountain punched Oberyn's teeth out, there would be teeth on the floor with this impact to the anvil.
Certainly, yeah.
Kit Harington's smile would not have been as pretty. He still got his ass, though.
Oh, boy. Do I ever.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R. R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
We got the... face off with Ygritte. It's funny because a lot of people saw the parallel between this, that Jon hesitated to kill her and that spared her life. She ended up being able to run off and get back with her people. She hesitated to kill him, which ended up saving him and dooming her as well. Because the little kid from the village kills him, and they have this weird head nod where he's like, "Yep, saved your ass, Jon." And Jon's like, "Feelings?" Ygritte rallies enough to say, "You know nothing, Jon Snow," and then that's pretty much it. How you weren't connected very much to Ygritte and Jon?
Almost not at all. In retrospect, I understand a little bit more, I guess, why Ygritte shot Jon, why she was unable to kill Jon here. It makes a lot of sense, but it doesn't do much for me in the feels.
You know?
It's like I don't. These are tangential characters. Jon Snow is. At this point, has only become a character for me this season. It's like all this shit happened to John way before I gave a shit about John either way. So now I don't give a shit about the stuff that happened to him back then.
Also, like, you know, Romeo and Juliet is compelling, but not if it was set in the Game of Thrones universe. Like, okay. I get your shit's torn up about this, but Oberon just got his head split open. The Starks were all murdered and wiped off the map.
Sure.
This is pretty, if it's
getting killed in the heat of battle is not surprising.
Like, this is the emotional centerpiece for almost any work of fiction or movie that you'd go see. Like, the fact that, you know, boy meets girl, boy loses girl, boy accidentally gets on the wrong side of girl in the battle and she gets killed. That's like the fucking high watermark for most pieces. But this is like the low laying fruit for Game of Thrones.
That's true. They've set the bar pretty high.
So it's like, if I'm going to give a fuck about Rob and Oberyn and Ed, by definition, I almost can't give a fuck about John or Ygritte, because I just, you know, there's people that say that, and there's several of them, men and women, that wrote in and said they teared up when Ygritte died. Wow. How do you watch? What are you torturing yourself on a weekly basis watching this show?
John has definitely come into his own, and I would care about what happens to John going forward.
Yeah.
It's just the Ygritte was not a part of John's new character very much in my mind. He became a character once he got away from Ygritte. Like, did the stuff that he had to do, came back, tried to warn the Night's Watch about the problems, people weren't listening. He kind of took matters into his own hands a little bit, and now he's a real character. So when he leaves at the end of this episode, I'm very curious to see how that turns out, and it would be tragic if he died at this point.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't really care about Ygritte. Sorry.
Right. We talked about how, you know, patently ridiculous the idea of men scaling this wall is in the heat of battle. It does pay off in a rather gruesomely awesome scene where Ed gives the order to drop the scythe. And they fucking do. It's this giant chain bladed thing. The chain looks like barbed wire, too.
Oh, boy.
And it just sweeps the whole front of the wall clean.
Yep.
Like, it doesn't matter. Like, all these guys were in the swath of the main blade proper, but it doesn't matter. You would have been knocked off the wall no matter what. It's horrific. Yeah. So that was pretty cool. A lot of people thought that that might be a nod to us book readers, because the climax of the Battle of the Blackwater, it wasn't just a wildfire, but Tyrion had a chain made that was the length of the bay, and it was submerged, and as soon as Stannis' fleet came in, it came up to like 3 feet above the water, so that once they were in there and the wildfire went off, none of those boats could escape.
Wow.
They tried to like backwater and get out, and nope, they were all caught in that conflagration.
Smart, Tyrion.
That was eliminated from the show, and a lot of people were like, well, that's kind of horseshit, because it was kind of like Tyrion's masterstroke.
Okay.
I wonder, or people wonder, if this wasn't, you know, kind of an unnecessary chain thrown in as a nod to the book reader. It's like, you want your chain that turns the tide of the battle? Here's your fucking chain.
So,
you bunch of monkeys.
Chain not in the book?
No, this Psy thing is not in the book.
Huh. Okay.
It's badass. It's cool.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
In fact, when it first happened, I thought he said drop the side, like that the wall had detachable sheets of ice that they could just pull and the whole fucking thing falls off. And I'm like,
well, this is better. That's brutal,
but it's kind of short-sighted. You can't pop that. But this thing, you could just, you know, winch back up and do it again.
Yep.
Anyway, surely nobody would try to climb the wall after that, though.
I wouldn't think so, no.
It's like, hey, I got to the part where there's just a streak of blood and the hand sticking out of the wall. I got to turn back, boss. We see that Tormund's finally, the fighting at the downstairs portion of the wall and Castle Black has died down. Mm-hmm. It's just basically Tormund with about 3 arrows sticking out of him, about to lose consciousness from lack of blood. But he's not going to go down easy. John ends up shooting him in the leg of the crossbow and starts his career as a guard in Skyrim.
Oh, Jesus. Okay.
No, he slaps him in chains. They're going to interrogate him, presumably next episode.
Yeah, which is worse than death for him, right? He doesn't want to be interrogated and kept alive. He wants to die gloriously in battle, I think.
For a wildling to be captured by what they call, referred to as kneelers, people south of the wall are kneelers, and held captive, yes, I would imagine that would be a fate worse than death for a wildling.
He's like a Klingon, essentially.
Sure.
Okay.
A more fair-skinned, red-haired
Slightly less rigid, non-turtle glued
to the forehead Klingon, sure.
Yeah, okay.
We have Sam and Gilly being joyfully reunited. And also, I think I skipped over this in a part, when Janos got chucked off the wall. Sadly, not literally. Krin said he was just wanted blow, and he decided to take that to fuck off from the battle and lock himself in Gilly's hidey hole.
Speaking, okay, so there's a couple things I want to say. I want to go back real quick to Tormund. That line that John has as he's walking away is just awesome. The pure awesome. Where Tormund is like, I should have thrown you off the wall. Yeah. He's like, yes, you should have.
That's awesome. I like that too. John's got a lot of that, I've done plenty wrong and stuff this season.
Sure.
Maybe they're just giving him better badass one-liners.
And he's better at delivering them. I don't know that he could have done this in season one or two.
Yeah. He's filled out.
Yeah.
He's filled out as a man. What do you think is going to happen with the Slint here? Squinty Slinty.
I don't know. He seems like they need everyone at the wall that they've got.
Right.
But he's too cowardly, not even to fight, but to command. Like, he's not even willing to give orders up there on the wall.
Well, did you notice the difference between, like, him and John and Alistair and, God, even Ed giving commands versus his, this is just organized rabble and, you know, there's no... He's, like, almost trying to psych himself out
rather than
worrying about the men around him, and the men around him could tell that.
Sure.
Like, pretty doubtful.
Makes him ineffective. Yeah, so I don't know what they do with him. I don't know if he gets punished for leaving the wall. I don't know if...
What do you want to see
I could
happen?
See that happening. I guess I want to see him... Some repercussions for him leaving the wall, leaving his post.
Some repercussions. I'll put you down for some repercussions.
Beheading? Is that a fitting repercussion?
Is that the repercussion you want to go with? I'm just making an official note here, that's all.
I feel like Alistair Thorne, who's been slashed about the groin... should stand up, walk up to this guy, and dress him down in a violent manner.
Give him a groin slashing.
Say,
also
this is
not
what...
prohibited by the Night's Watch vows.
No, that's true. But I mean, the fact that he went down there and he took a knife to his dick, and this guy hid in a lower cavern, like, this is bullshit. And Alistair Thorne should tell him so and show him so.
Yeah. Yeah, it'd be funny if Gilly was, like, giving it to him the whole time, too. You know,
him with
my
the,
not quite
boyfriend,
lock? Fat coward Sam that you're always making fun of. He's out there fighting and you're cowering in here.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, in light of day, a lot of Black Brothers have died. But they did hold the castle for one day. John decides he's going to go out and find Mance and kill him in single combat.
What do you think about that? Good idea, bad idea?
John himself says it's a bad plan.
Sure, okay.
But what plan do you got?
That's a thing, yeah.
What do you think... It's a good question. What do you think is going through John's mind? Like, if it's a bad plan, then at best you're depriving the wall of one of its best defenders and commanders left standing.
That's true, I hadn't thought of that.
At worst... all that happens, plus you die a horrible, gruesome death, and
I think there are two things going through his mind here. The first one, the least important one, being we're all dead if I don't do this. If I don't find a way to end this battle, we can't survive it. The second, more important thing here is he just lost Ygritte, and we know we had the speech from Sam saying, "Oh, without Gilly, I have nothing." All that also, I think, is what John is thinking at this point. Like, I've got nothing left to lose. I'm a dead man up on this wall. The only way to stop this thing is to go out there and do something stupid, but what do I care? I've got nothing.
Yep. Booty is the death of duty, as Master Aemon said.
Yeah.
John's lost his booty. He doesn't, you know, nothing more to live for.
Yeah.
The ginger minge has been taken off the menu.
Yep.
So, yeah, it's a bad plan, but what's yours? They go out and see Grin. He held the gate. That would have been an awesome battle to see. Six Black Brothers versus one pissed off giant in a super tight ice corridor. Barehanded, too. I don't think that giant had a weapon on him.
Probably not, no.
But probably something you could sing a song about, but we didn't get to see it. Then at the end, Sam tells John the promise to come back, and John gives that response the proper... Whether you hear someone wanting you to promise dying or they're wanting to just put the tip in, just give him a smirk and keep walking. That's A-Rod's official advice.
Yeah, I like that reaction.
Give him a smirk and keep watching. Yeah, sure, the tip. Maybe later. I'm smirking and walking. Walking and smirking. Mm-hmm. That's the end of the episode.
Yeah, I think people thought that I was more hard on this episode than I actually was in the instant cast.
No, I got a lot of those types of emails. Disappointed that you didn't like the episode. And
they lump me with you. That's the problem. Because you were definitely more negative than I was in the instant cast. And people just glom onto that and they say, I can't believe how negative you guys were.
It's payback for all the times you've forgotten people's names and people you send in. I can't believe you guys can't keep the name straight. It's like, okay. I'll bear that. I'll put myself on that cross with Jim. No, so I understand that. I mean, I probably even sounded more negative than I did. I like this episode. It's a good episode, but it is, I guess I was thinking it was going to be a little bit more epic, and you know, some of the problems out of the battle were like, I understand when the budget's not there, but some of the things, it just didn't seem like it would cost that much. And, you know, take out the swinging Psi and spend a little bit on making the probing scouting force a little bit more believable, or have a hope that, you know, it seemed like a suicide mission the way it was designed and played out in film. Mm-hmm. Spend the same amount of money, but just, you know, maybe spend a little bit smarter. And, you know, some things, like, I do care about Sam and Gilly. Do you care about Sam and Gilly?
More than I probably should.
Okay.
I care about Sam a lot.
I feel you on that.
And by extension, I care about Gilly. Without Sam, no, I don't care about Gilly.
But, you know, Egret and John, never one I really connected with in the books or in the series.
That's really the big thing that fell flat for me this episode is that. And that was supposed to be one of the emotional cruxes, other than Sam, of this episode. So that part didn't hit me. It was sufficiently epic, I thought.
Yeah.
Though not quite as epic as Blackwater, that's a fucking high bar to jump over.
Sure.
So this was epic. Don't get me wrong.
Many people still say it's the best episode of Game of Thrones. I
agree.
I don't know, man.
I think it is.
Still Over the Mountain and the Viper.
Yeah, when I did the rewatch.
Or Over the Laws of God and Men. I mean, there's been a lot of really good episodes this season. I feel like one of those has taken over.
Maybe. They're close, but man, Blackwater was epic.
Plus the whole, I mean, that's the thing. The whole buildup of that season was to that.
Sure.
Whereas we had a little bit, you know, like, oh, it's going to be 100,000 Walker, but nobody's really taking it serious. And the stakes, mm-hmm. into this episode, really nothing has changed. We still have 100,000 Walkers. We still have a whole lot less, wildlings. We still have a whole lot less Black Brothers on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
John's going out in the gates, but that's the only thing that's changed. So,
and even if everything had changed, even if the wall had fallen and 100,000 troops come rolling in, they're still miles and miles and miles away from anyone that I give a shit about.
Right.
Right. I mean, I don't care if Ramsay and Roose die. Who cares?
That, I mean, they're the wildlings closest. Blowing through and cleansing the north might be a good thing.
That's A-okay by me.
Yeah.
So, like, the imminent threat was the thing that made Blackwater so interesting and so cool.
And the reactions of like, you know, how is Tyrion going to react? How is Joffrey going to react? How is Cersei and Sansa?
Mm-hmm.
And even Shay fucking had a moment to shine. All those people we arguably care more about than anyone at the wall, except for maybe Jon.
Maybe, yeah.
And even then, a lot of those people are over Jon.
Sure.
So I don't think it's the fault of the episode. And, you know, it's not like they did a bad job. But even in the books, I'm way more invested in Jaime and Brienne's relationship, which I think half of which is in my head.
Maybe.
Than John and Egret's actual relationship.
Yeah.
And I don't know that that makes me a bad person. It's just the way I feel about it.
Sure.
Anything else you want to talk about this episode in particular, or should we get into a little bit light pimping?
Yeah, let's do that.
Heavy pimping on the way to feedback.
Sure.
We are proud to have Hover.com sponsoring our podcast. Let me tell you why. Hover makes registering and transferring domains easy and painless. And if you've ever experienced other registrars, you know that's hardly a universal experience. Confusing searches, bad interfaces, sneaky add-ons during the checkout process, these all can cost you money and leave you scratching your head. But Hover sees things differently. They only sell you what you need for a hassle-free, fair price. Security? Built in. Privacy? Included. And if you do manage to run into trouble, they have a no-wait, no-hold, no transfer phone service. And that's a real live person, by the way, not some automated press 2 to enter the 7th level of hell kind of crap other people call support. And best of all, By using our special promo code CASTLEBLACK, you can get 10% off of your first order. That's Castle Black, all one word. So what are you waiting for? Get over to hover.com today. We have been up to a lot of stuff here at baldmove.com since we went full time. We've got complete coverage of the new Fargo show on FX. It's awesome. We're also covering 24, Live Another Day. Honestly, less awesome, but we're having a lot of fun with it. And starting this week, I'm doing Orange is the New Black with a rotating all-star list of female co-hosts, including The Because Show's Amy, Up Your Downstairs' Kelly, and Project Fandom's Nina. Just recorded the podcast for the first episode of Nina this afternoon. In fact, had a great time. Check out all that stuff and more at baldmove.com. Of course, we appreciate all your support. There's several ways you can do that. First of all, is subbable.com/baldmove. It's a voluntary subscription site. Pay us whatever you think is fair, and you can take those bucks and bank them for valuable and exciting rewards. Check it out at subbable.com/baldmove. And also, if you're on Amazon and you're not using our affiliate link, it's a damn shame, because you can go to amazon.baldmove.com. Everything you buy using that link, it's no extra charge for you. There's no shipping, no extra handling. You get the great Amazon service, shipping, and support. And you send a little tiny piece of love our way. And it's how we pay the bills around here at Bald Move. Last but not least, you can't do any of that stuff. We appreciate you listening. Can you give us a rating review on iTunes? Can you send us some feedback? Last but not least, if you can't do any of that, there's two things you can do that cost you nothing but a teeny amount of time. One is rate and review us on iTunes if you think we're doing a good job. Two, tell a family member or a friend or a coworker about Bald Move. We would love to have them. We know what to do with them. Just send them our way. Okay, feedback section. We got Tackel. He wants to play the name game with us. Watchers on the Wall are Watchers of the Wall. Whoa.
Hey now.
There's some cheating bullshit right
some
in the
gerrymandering going on here.
Mance Raider from the North, the Wilding Group from the South, and the Night's Watch.
They're all watching.
If we put the parentheses of in between Watchers and Wall, then I think I'll have to give you that point. They want to know, why didn't they let Ghost out earlier? I feel like that until Sir Alistair and Fel and Slint got out of the way, that John couldn't just disobey direct orders. Mm-hmm. Like, where are you going, Snow? I'm going to unlock my direwolf. No, I mean, they just don't. No one trusts the direwolf but like John and his close friends.
Yeah, pretty much.
And it's kind of amazing that he's like, has a very finely tuned friend or foe sense, I guess, because he's able to just pick out the wildlings from the Black Brothers.
Sure.
By scent, probably. Also, want to know, where's Maester Aemon in all this fighting? That's actually a pretty good question.
In the library. Why not?
All right. And will Jon Snow tell Mance that the mission succeeded? Since Mance does not know that he was a double agent, Jon could just go back in with the wildlings. Ooh, that's a good point.
He doesn't know that? I guess he wouldn't, right? They were on the south side of the wall before they even knew that.
Right.
Hmm.
Unless there's a way that they could somehow get a warg message back. Crow, I don't think they have that capability.
Yeah, I don't know. That's an interesting thought that I hadn't even considered.
Just walk up. Welcome back, my lord. Knife. Michael P. says, I've incorporated Notch Draw Loose into the finale of my lovemaking.
Oh, Jesus.
But do you have a burly dude standing over your bed shouting it at you? Yeah. That's what takes it over the top.
And do you sometimes think that Notch means loose?
Right. And did you know, are you called a fucking coont? Ron from South Carolina said, do you guys think the Mance army looked relatively small compared to Danny's Unsullied army? I thought Mance army was over 100,000. Hard to tell.
We just saw the tip. Yeah, that's all.
I will say that there was a promotional poster for this episode where it was a shot from the wall looking down over the Sea of Fire and all the campfires that dotted, and it looked a lot more epic than anything we saw in this episode.
Okay.
I think it did a much better job at showing, like, you know, what 100,000 dudes would look like. A Cowboys Texas stadium full of dudes would look like. Markham said, oh, this is the geography of the wall, which we talked. So I'm going to give you some dry pie there, Mark. Wash it down some Dornish wine. It'll be okay. Mike from New Jersey said, I saw three things in episode did visually that I don't think we've seen yet. The first was the awesome 43-second single cut, although likely green screened. I don't know, because that is an actual set that's filmed in a quarry. It's a freestanding set, that whole practice yard. Mm-hmm. So I feel like they could spin around at, you know, light it at night and get a full 360. Surely there's probably some compositing and digital actors and stuff, but I bet a lot of that was physical. When John knows nothing, Snow gets to the bottom of the elevator. I can't think of a time when the show did a long action cut like that. For the ultimate in single action cut, look up the 6-minute drug raid from True Detective, mm-hmm. which we talked about. Second, slightly stranger thing they did differently this episode was a 42 style shaky cam zoom in looking down the wall right before they dropped the fucking awesome Pendulum of Death.
That is a Battlestar Galactica shot if I've ever seen one.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. You want zoom and shake? Watch Battlestar Galactica. Holy shit.
That looked out of place on a show that seems to love the wide pan cinema style shooting. The third strange move is to fade the white closeout. I didn't like that at all. All right. I mean, I think the third one, fade the white, was a nice, I don't know, you're walking through a dark tunnel and
yeah,
it's opposite of fade to black.
HDR.
Yeah. you got a light bloom.
Yep.
the second thing, as far as the shaky cam, I detest shaky cam. I really hate, like, the Bourne Identity, Mission Impossible, where you can't... I mean, I like...
Show no action, action sequences?
Yes, yes. Yeah. I like to see the action. You pay these guys to coordinate stunts and to fight them, then I fucking would like to see and know what the hell's going on.
Yeah, it's Jackie Chan versus Matt Damon.
There you go, and I'll take Jackie every yep. day of the week and twice on Sunday. Pete says, I recently rewatched The Blackwater, and it was great, but largely due to the drama in King's Landing and the amazing acting all around by Tyrion and Cersei. We got the Hound cutting a few people in two, mm-hmm. Bronn torching the Bay with one well-placed arrow, but the battle is nothing in comparison to this. Seeing the Wildling army and the thin garrison of about 300, I would guess, penetrating and battling Castle Black was awesome. I love seeing Alistair in action versus Tormund, as well as Jon hammer the shit out of Big Bad Boss Thin. The battle has been one of the biggest slow burns in the show, and I think it paid off. Now what to do about the other 99,000? Yeah. So his first statement, I agree 100 wholeheartedly with.
Where does that first statement end for you?
Which is basically, was great, but largely due to the drama in King's Landing and the amazing acting all around by Tyrion and Cersei.
Yes.
That's also why I think it's better.
I agree. I also think that he's right that the battle part of this was better at the wall.
Certainly. There wasn't there much wasn't, battle.
Exactly. There was the thing in the bay, and then a couple of troops landed. Tyrion got his face cut.
Stannis going up a ladder and throwing some guys off the wall and then getting yep. drug away screaming by his own troops.
Not much of that at all. Yep. This battle, pure battle, was better. Yes, I agree with that.
But I also think it's like eating a big bowl of vanilla ice cream at a certain point. Like,
okay.
Without being able to cut away to those interesting pieces of acting and character moments, and... I guess they tried to do that. It just wasn't as good.
Okay.
It didn't hit. And it wasn't as good. It just didn't affect me as much. So yeah. That's all subjective. There's no right or wrong answer. I keep telling myself that as the hate mail rolls in and I cry myself to sleep. Rebecca D says, Maester Aemon scene didn't fully land for me. I think the show wanted to remind us who he was, but it was a strange time to do that. His reveal to Jon in season one made me shiver, but the reveal to Sam was more Maester Aemon passed on the throne family wealth and women to raise other people's dysfunctional whiny sons on an ice cube. That's crummy.
So I like the Aemon stuff in that it was trying to set a tone for this battle. They tried to set the same kind of despairing tone that they did in the Blackwater episodes. I just don't think they spent long enough on it, and I don't think the characters were there for it.
I think that's the whole reason that's there, and they spent so much time with Sam is because the whole emotional backbone was Sam and Gilly. That
Sam,
was
Gilly,
the emotional
and John
stakes.
And Ygritte.
Well, yeah, John and Ygritte, but that's it. You didn't have a whole city full of people and the fate of a whole kingdom and all that stuff. I mean, arguably, the wall falls, bad things happen.
But if I'm really concerned about that, there needs to be like a city right on the other side of the wall that's going to be torched and... they're going to go through raping and pillaging immediately.
Yeah, like whereas at currently, Storm Winterfell, go ahead.
Yeah, why
Dreadful,
not?
Dreadful, fuck it up. The twins, fuck it up twice harder. Yeah, there's nothing. Like, you know, there's a bunch of bad guys in the north, and they need to be taken care of.
Sure.
Moving on to Dan M. said, I was rewatching the show the other day while taking a tally of the members of the Night's Watch who died during the battle. Oh, he's got a corpse count for us.
Okay.
Keep in mind that we don't see a lot of Egret's arrows where they end up, and it's sometimes hard to tell who's who, but the number I reached of total Night's Watch deaths confirmed on screen was 43. That would leave them...
Whoa! 43 brothers died?
Yeah. That seems believable to me. Because I was thinking that the whole time, how many people Egret herself slaughtered.
She shot a lot of arrows, but I didn't think we saw 43 deaths.
You gotta think of, like, every time that thin guy swung his sword, or swung his axe right into someone's mid, that's lethal.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So, that leaves us 59 men. Then you take away John, who's gone on north, Thorn, who's injured, Master Aemon, who's 80-some years old. And sure. The show, he's over 100, but in real life, he's 80-something.
Wow.
That's 56. Then you have to imagine a few more who are injured. Oh, and one other thing, and the Maester Aemon, the girl Aemon was talking about, he has a theory.
Okay.
It's Lady Olenna Tyrell. Remember at the beginning of the season when she said she was betrothed to some Targaryen? You never know. And she was also very forward. Came in, sucked the head of the dragon.
Just the tip.
Just the tip. I don't know. I feel like he's old, too old. Like, he was a, you know, he could have been a man in his 20s or 30s by the time she was born.
Really?
He's 102 years old, I believe, in the books.
102?
I do believe that's how old he is.
I would not have guessed more than 70. In a world like that, I don't know how you live to 102.
Well, you know, it doesn't help.
Unless you have, like, elf blood or something.
It doesn't hurt that you're got the blood of the dragon and you're a maester and...
I guess.
Who knows all that stuff.
Then, yeah, he's probably 20 years older than... 20 to 30 years older than...
Yeah, that's... Yeah, let me check this age. The Westerosi wiki said that he's born in 198 and it's around 300 in the book. So, yeah, 102 years old.
Jesus, okay.
Old and crusty as shit.
Yep.
Old as crusty as 102-year-old shit.
Old like Yoda.
But strong theory. Definitely.
When 100 years old, you become look as good you not.
Stiff as tip yours? No, I can't do that. I don't have a good Yoda today. Laz says, this episode is not without fault for sure. The episode is directed by Neil Marshall. And the problem here is that maybe because the same director is back and the battle borrows so many beats from Blackwater. Think about it. In the Blackwater, the battle is preempted by bells from the city and drums from Stannis' fleet. Here it was horns doing the same thing. Not just once, though, but over and over again throughout the fight. Secondly, again, it's a night battle, which says more about trying to hide budget restraints than being an aesthetic choice. But I hope that one day we'll see a large-scale battle under glorious sunlight rather than a late night for all. Yeah, I don't mind the night battles. I think that feels more epic.
Yeah, and I, you know, unless one person has a specific advantage during the day, yeah, why not? Makes it harder for people to see you coming up the wall.
Perhaps most significantly for me is when Egret was shot by Ollie the Kid. It was exactly the same camera shot as when Bronn killed the guy on fire who was charging the hound in the Blackwater. In the original camera shot, it cuts to Bronn looking like a boss and giving a little nod, which is fine because he's Bronn, and it was a Bronn pose. But this 10-year-old kid is not a badass warrior. In fact, he's a terrified child. Having him shoot Egret is fine, but then giving him the boss pose and nod just didn't work for me.
Well, he got a pep talk from Sam. And then he knew that he did John a favor there, or at least he thought he did. Yeah, I guess I'm with
you. This kid went from plugging his ears and shitting his pants to giving the alpha male nod to John after killing, you know, the Ginger Minge. I don't know. I feel there a little bit on that.
A little bit, yeah.
Or I guess Laz could be a guy. I don't know.
Laz? I don't know. I've never heard that name.
Probably Lauren. I probably just called it. Sir or Madam, I'm with you. With you now, I am. Tim from Australia. I do have a hard time buying that Janos Slynt could be that useless and cowardly, given that he rose to be leader of the Gold Cloaks in King's Landing. Apparently, he wasn't a knight before his grubby promotion by Cersei or Joffrey, so you'd think he must have risen through the ranks as a soldier or guard first. Do you think it would have been better if Mance had made an appearance in this episode? It may have given a face to the wildling horde north of the wall. Let's take that last point.
Okay.
Could we have seen a shot of Mance Rayder coming in looking like a badass? You know, when the whole line of of the wildlings advance, should we have seen him looking on impassively?
So if they were going to do that, they also have to make his tactics better. Otherwise, I think he's a joke.
Okay, we could right? that all those things. Yes, I, that's I'm what, with you. I'm with you. I'm buying
so
this pitch.
So now the tactics I could buy, you know, some one of his generals is like, oh, go up there and hit this wall, try and get this gate down. Whereas he's like, God damn it, I said not to move. Did I say knock that's loose right. and draw? No. Or other way around.
Did I say to fucking climb?
So I can't blame him on it. Had they shown him, I could blame him. So I'm glad they didn't show him with the weak tactics that they displayed.
Right on. What do you think about his opinion of Janos Slynt?
Yeah, I don't know anything about his background. He says that he probably rose through the guard. Do you know anything about that? Do you know a history of Janos?
I feel like they might have even mentioned spoilery? This in the show. That's one of the things that Tyrion threw in his face when he dismissed him to the wall. But this guy rose up the ranks more through taking bribes and being deceitful and greasing people's palms than he did because he was a good commander of men.
Yeah. And they definitely portrayed that vibe. So if that's the case, I think they got him right.
Right.
If he's supposed to be a soldier, they got him wrong.
Moving on to Sir Scott, the Mammoth Slayer. If we've been wondering where they've been spending the budget this season, Giants riding freaking mammoths, man. As I was watching, I did think that this was Michelle McLaren directing because the action was excellent, but Neil Marshall did well. Personally, John's storyline has been rather slow, and I've always been anxious that the amount of time spent on or beyond the wall was time I could have been seeing Tyrion or my favorite pairing of Arya and the Hound. But this time, Maester Aemon talking about his younger conquests and lost love, Jon taking command, Sam being awesome and finally kissing the girl, Ghost getting out and ripping a wildling apart, Giants riding freaking mammoths, Grin saying the oath and holding the gate, Ygritte's dying breath, you know nothing, Jon Snow. Apparently, Sir Scott is over the moon about this episode. Very satisfied.
A lot of the stuff he likes, I like too.
Same. Same.
He just doesn't say anything negative about it.
Nathan P. said, love the episode, but I have to completely disagree with Jon Snow at the end. His idea to kill Mance Rayder to end the war is ridiculous. Do you really think that the Wildlings would stop attacking if their leader was gone? The Night's Watch itself has proven that they don't need an official leader. The constant stream of people taking control of the archers proves this. If a ragtag team of rapists and outcasts can manage to organize themselves, I'm sure that the violent and vengeful wildlings can do the same. Even if Jon manages to kill Mance, another wildling would just take his place, resulting in just an even more angry and united enemy.
So, small exception with that, the Night's Watch is fighting for their fucking lives.
Their fucking lives!
You
coots!
They don't have a choice but to continue this battle. Whereas Mance's army doesn't have that same impetus. They're not right. facing certain death if they don't fight back.
Right.
So if they kill Mance, do they still have the motivation to even try and get through this wall? What's the point for them?
Also,
they're tired of not having the shit that the South has, right?
And this is their culture, too. Their culture is very much, we do our own thing and fuck you for trying to tell us otherwise. They're almost always, you know, even though there's tons of people and they could have been a threat to the Night's Watch at any time, they weren't until Mance, who's supposedly just badass warlord, was able to unite all of them. And I do think that if they did kill Mance, it's not like they would all just go home and like cry. But what would happen is kind of like what tore the Mongol Empire apart. The people would fight and be like, well, I'm the leader. It's like, fuck, you're not the leader. I'm the leader. And the giants and the thins and the hornfoots and everybody else would fight. And it would just disintegrate into chaos that way.
Yeah, they'd certainly be less efficient.
So I feel like that's, you know, and the Mongol Empire is a very good example. Like, they were unstoppable and they're united beyond a single leader.
Yeah.
Whenever there was a problem with that leadership or transition, they completely ineffective. And very similar model. I mean, a bunch of disorganized tribes based on family alliances and units, all that, et cetera, et cetera.
Dan Carlin,
I'm going
to
suck him off right now. He's satisfied. Didn't violate my vows in Night's Watch, and we can move on.
Dan Carlin, never just a tip.
Never
it's all or nothing
tip.
For
it's
him.
It's four
man.
Hours of podcast coming down your throat. Ben G, why aren't giants a bigger deal in the Game of Thrones universe? Imagine an army of 1,000 giants. Even 10 or 20 giants would be hell to deal with. Why isn't a giant sitting on the Iron Throne? How intelligent are giants supposed to be? It seems odds that giants play no part in this Game of Thrones.
All good questions. I think a giant army would be super formidable. Giants, maybe, I don't know. Obviously, they're not on the throne, so there's something holding them back.
Well, so this is a fantasy trope. The fact that, like, man is unstoppable. They're not...
Sure.
They're not... that impressive physically. They don't have any particular magic talents, but you unleash them on a continent, and they, you know, you got children of the forest who can warg and green sea and fucking sunder a continent in half. They fucking steamroll them. You got giants and mammoths and shadow cats and grumpkins and all the other things. They just outproduce and outthink and outfuck you into an early grave. And I feel like that's exactly what's happening here.
It makes me think that giants are quite scarce.
Yeah, I mean,
like,
think about it.
Maybe they've got 10 more.
Right.
Like, really, really endangered species level scarce.
Right, right. And they... And think about it. Just imagine that a giant, like an elephant, maybe they've got a 24-month gestation period.
Sure.
You know, you can pop out 3 men for every 1 giant.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if they live up in the mountains of the far north, they probably got meager supplies and they can't. I mean, there's so many technological reasons they could be dead. But certainly in the story of Game of Thrones, they are a dwindling thing. Just like giants. You think, how the hell did giants ever get extinct?
Yeah.
That's a good open question for Westeros. You know, whatever happened to the giants?
Wait, giants?
I'm sorry, dragons.
Okay.
Whatever happened to the dragons?
Yeah.
Probably magic. Same reason we get a winters that span years and all that stuff. Benji says, why aren't the giants... Wait a second, I just read this. Coryell said, Ygritte's death kind of bothered me. First of all, because I felt like Ygritte was too badass to give two flying fucks about Jon Snow. I also really hated her last words. She's really forcing that catchphrase. And also, the scene contained two of my most hated tropes. One, character in mortal danger is saved by an assailant getting stabbed in the back by an unseen character, which already happened to Jon Snow earlier this season. And two, character in the middle of the battle stopping to grieve over death without being decapitated.
Happened in Blackwater.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, of course.
Tyrion, yeah.
Tyrion and Pod the Rod.
Yep.
Number two always does bug me, but I guess it's poetic license.
Okay.
You know,
I could buy that.
That is absolutely right. Every wildling's reaction to seeing a black brother cradling a body is going to be coming in there and easing their misery.
Sure.
So, but what are you going to do? It's a they call them tropes for a reason. David J said Rose Leslie, that's Ygritte for the use not know, is a great actor, and I'm really going to miss having her character on the show. But it seemed like a wasted opportunity to have Sam tell Ollie to pick up a weapon to fight rather than John. They both matured a lot through the episode, but John was a leader and the repercussions and that had more of repercussions to it.
Yes.
He had a chat with Alistair Thorne. He also sent Grin to his probable death defending the gate. He went down himself and killed a Thin in a nasty brawl, showing that he learned from Carl after all. Then he was happy to see Ygritte again, and I think happy that she was still safe and alive.
Mm-hmm.
I did like that reaction, the fact that, yeah, you're probably going to murder me, but I'm still happy to see you.
That, and I'm 100% on board here. If John had been the one to tell Ollie to get back in this fight and pick up a bow, and he used that bow to kill Ygritte, holy shit, that's more devastating.
Oh, no, it would be... in fact, I'm kind of amazed that they didn't do it that way.
Yeah.
It does seem like a missed opportunity. And that's what he says. The scene would have a lot more impact for me if it had been his order that Ollie had killed rather than Sam, since it had, you know, he basically says, so dry pie for you, David J. Thanks for the email. And we kind of agree with you.
Certainly.
Connor O said, damn you, Ygritte. Tormund was clearly about to tell one of his awesome stories about laying with the she-bear when Ygritte shut him down. Even though we didn't get the whole story, I did appreciate the nod to the book readers and was a little bummed it didn't end with a har. Yeah, okay. Tormund's always making dick jokes in the books.
Oh, all right. I don't know that.
And they've really toned that down for him in the episode. So, this was a little of a nod to us readers.
Dick jokes, definitely not outside the wheelhouse of HBO. I can tell you that.
Or bald move.
yeah.
Dan from Manchester. You're making a Silicon Valley
Oh, my God, yes. The finale of that show. Wow.
I see over there. Dan from Manchester says, I was rewatching the show the other day while taking a tally of... Whoa. Sorry. I must have copied this twice. Let's move on to Inti A, who has some combat experience. It sounds like even medieval combat experience. He's fought in some reenactments.
Okay.
Involving... bladed Japanese weaponry.
Oh, shit.
I had to cut his a big email. I had to cut a lot down. But here's the stuff that I thought was really intriguing. As far as the tunnel gate, all good defenses have one vulnerable point, which is created on purpose. Why? Because the enemy will try to take advantage of it, so that point becomes a predictable point of entry. A predictable enemy is a dead enemy. I wouldn't have sealed up the tunnel, but instead have a major defense hidden if possible there, like that big fucking arrow gun that killed the giant with.
Shoot that down the hall. Yeah.
Not that I would expect giants to come through there, but even with common soldiers, two or four of those things near the entrance on the southern side would demolish any troops heading through the tunnel. In fact, I was severely disappointed that they didn't have pole arms there. It would have been a huge advantage for something so simple.
Mm-hmm.
To me, this is the biggest strategic fail. It doesn't matter if Rance Mader has 10,000 or 100,000 troops. There can only so many that fit through these tunnels, and after a while, they'd have to crawl over their own dead to get close to that inner gate. And if they somehow managed to get to the other side, you would only have to blow the tunnel to cave it in. And they had explosives, right? So this is my biggest problem with the whole episode.
The tactics.
Because in the books, it goes down exactly that way.
Really?
This inner gate was bristling with like murder holes and ports that you could fire arrows, and it was a fucking bloody battle. And this giant, the impressive thing was this giant managed to fight and claw his into that, rend the gates open, and kill the Black Brothers despite of it, and it devolved to hand-to-hand. Also, it wasn't Grin holding that gate. The Night's Watch is in such bad shape. And in the books, Sir Alistair and Slint hadn't even gotten there yet. It was the one-armed, crippled blacksmith that was in command doing all this and doing the heroic last stand. So it was even more badass.
Yeah.
And I don't feel like it would have cost any more money to do it that way. And just
it might have. You
got to
get more on-screen giant, but...
But just reducing that to one giant bull rushing into six guys with swords, like he says, the Night's Watch doesn't have fucking spears.
And then cutting away.
Stick the spears through those iron gates and see how much of a bum rush he could do against it.
Yeah.
You know, that's
sad. I wish I didn't know how the books did this because it sounds 1,000 times more epic.
Well, now you're living in my world. He also said, this is about the South walls being so low. I answered that for the historical purpose that, you know, it's not supposed to defend against the South. It's only supposed to defend against the North. Mm-hmm. And if the Night's Watch are fully armed and operational, again, this is the defense in depth. They got the wall. They got 13 castles along the wall. They're supposed to have a couple hundred guys in it. They're supposed to patrol the top of the wall nightly, daily. They're supposed to have cut the forest a mile back from the wall in all directions so wildlings can't sneak up on them.
Yeah.
One of the big things is now that the whole country treats the Night's Watch like a glorified penal colony, none of that shit's happening. They only have 3 castles manned. Everywhere beyond the castles are manned, the forest is growing up right to the wall, so you can't see wildlings approaching. It's a shit show.
Hmm.
They manage to patrol the wall maybe every other week. So it's a system. It's kind of like in the Wire, you know. It's systemic failures of society that contribute to these rots that happen and these threats that come about. Anyway, I think that's it. We just got a big spoiler section to consider.
Okay.
So next week's the big finale.
Mm-hmm.
We have a week after that, which we'll have the season wrap up, and we'll be talking. Season wrap up is kind of light spoilery in that I talk about differences from the books to the show. The danger of that is they could always take plot lines that they didn't quite directly use and reincorporate those in the future plots. You know, like I talked about the chain in the Blackwater battle, and that might be considered a spoiler because they had a big chain defense at the wall. But, you know, I think that's a pretty narrow view of the word spoiler. That's what's coming up in 2 weeks. Next week will probably be pretty epic. We're wrapping up, you know, I can't say what we're wrapping up. We're not wrapping up. But what we had to deal with, we've got the wall. You know, what's going to happen with Jon? What's going to happen with the wall? What's going to happen with Tyrion?
Yep.
Who else are we missing? What's
Arya and the Hound being at the Eyrie is
Arya and the Hound, what's going on with that?
Yeah.
You know, what's going on with Dany? We haven't visited that side of the world since Jorah got dismissed.
Yeah.
Lots of stuff up in the air, lots of balls. How many of those balls are they going to punt the next season? How many are they going to resolve this season? I, myself, am insanely curious to find out. How about you, Jim?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, we'll be there Sunday night with the instant cast for the finale, and we'll be there next Tuesday for the full cast. If you'd like to send email for any and all of that, it's gameofthrones@baldmove.com. Got our live show threads and our podcast threads on facebook.com/baldmove. You can always get at Jim on Twitter at Bald Move. Please, no spoilers to Jim. We're trying to keep him unsullied. And that's it. Until next time, I'm your host, Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, a very special isn't your speed. We've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
Since the dawn of time, we've been putting clothes on our back that identify us with our people, our group, our tribe.
And while Bald Move might be one of the smallest, weirdest tribes out there, transcending all concepts of border, class, culture, and creed, we still have respect for the old ways.
At support.baldmove.com, you can get t-shirts, hats, mugs, and more. We have something for every one of our podcasts, or just wear the four pips of the Bald Move logo with pride.
Bald Move merch beats running around naked, and they make a great gift for the Bald Move fan in your life. Join our tribe! Head over to support.baldmove.com and click on merch to start shopping.
Okay, we're in a spoiler section, and we've got a lot to get to, so let's dig right into it. Hef says, I think with Sir Alistair's pre-battle comments to John and his later wounding, Sir Alistair may back John for the new Lord Commander and will become more of an ally to John than in the books, alongside Ed and Sam, since Grin and Pip are both undeniably dead. That is some quality speculation, Hef. I don't see anything wrong with it. It wouldn't surprise me if Sir Alistair actually ends up dying. And maybe his dying words throw a little bit of weight behind John as the Lord Commander, and they kind of dispense with the whole election plot. Or maybe the election's just between John and Slint, who would be handily defeated. I don't see them wasting a lot of time on that part of the plot. So having Sir Alistair either throw himself in and then die, or throw himself in and then live as his right-hand man, that part of it's what I have a trouble buying, because I just can't see Sir Alistair, proud man that he is, surviving and being hale and hearty and deciding to be subordinate to John. If anything, I could see him maybe respecting John in a new way and wanting him to be his right-hand man, but I don't know. It'll be interesting to see how the show handles that. Aaron W. says, Episode 9 had some interesting moments, but the thing that struck me is Ammon's talk with Sam about loving a woman. I seem to remember some rumor and speculation that Ammon at least knew who John's real father was, and some have even suggested that he could be John's father. Could the old object of affection he's talking about possibly be John's real mother? No fucking way, because he's way too old. Also, that you might have gotten the R plus L equals J theory conflated with some other Targaryen, because as far as I know, Ammon has no clue of John's true parentage. That if you subscribe to the R plus L equals J theory, that he is a secret Targaryen prince. I just don't see that. And there's, as far as I know, again, John being the mother, if Ammon is 102, how old would John's mother have to be to make that a realistic pairing? Keep in mind that Ammon spent most of his life as a maester and at the wall, where he's pledged not to have any children. So I just don't think the timeline works out. But decent bit of speculation still. Rebecca B. says, in the books, Egret's party of wildlings heads immediately to attack Castle Black, but John gets back in time to warn the Night's Watch. They fight the south side battle first and have the north side battle. It was kind of awesome to have both battles go on at the same time in the show. There's probably all sorts of practical reasons to make that happen simultaneously, but it did create a few problems. One, Egret's death in the book happened just after John left her, separating them for a whole season before killing her was kind of crummy. Agreed. Mance had hoped to avoid a frontal assault that would have added depth to watch him hear the news that the Southside attack had failed, knowing that this means a lot of wildlings will have to die for a frontal assault to succeed. True. The entire wall plotline this season has been battle preparation, the small Southside battle, frantic recuperation, and Northside battle might have been a better arc. It would have been interesting if they had spread this across more than one episode, and they had the little mini set piece of the southern part of the commando assault happen in one episode, and then they could have spent a little bit more money and made a little bit more time to give that, you know, northern side assault a little bit more oomph. Because like I said in the feedback part of the podcast, I thought that was the most disappointing thing, that they reduced Mance's attack to very simplistic and brainless things. You know, the commando raid, you know, it fails. That's one thing. Then you have a frontal assault that doesn't involve people climbing the wall under withering fire, and it doesn't involve advancing without any kind of support. You know, it just makes it look like both sides were smart and they're trying to adapt to each other's tactics. And it certainly was more moving. You know, they could have dropped Grin into place. Replacing Donald Noyle with Grin is not problematic, but having it a single, you know, giant battling Grin, I think, is problematic for all the reasons I talked about in the feedback. So this, most of the time when they've singled onto a single location, it's been to good effect. This is one of the few times where they spent a whole time in one location and it felt like maybe it would have been better if they had a part one of battle, part two of the battle, and then conclude with whatever they're going to do next. If it had been a better rhythm and had that better broken up. Chris F. said, I thought the episode delivered. We got Sir Alistair being a jerk, but also being a great leader. Unlike the book, he wasn't there for this battle. I thought for sure he died in a tunnel, actually as a stand-in for Donald Noy, rather. Noy? I don't know how you pronounce the guy's, but I've never heard it pronounced. Loved how they showed at the top of the wall with the dugout tunnels. It makes so much more sense than trying to fight on a flat ice rink with a 700-foot drop, which is how I pictured it in the books. Even though we knew, and maybe it's because I saw the series first, but I always imagined the at the top having some sort of wall, and that in the middle part that they gravel and salted it down, so it's like you got really nice firm footing up there. But anyway, even though we knew that kid was going to kill Egret, that scene was good anyway. I liked John's smile. It seemed genuine. His guard was probably way down after getting beat up so badly, and he was just happy to see her, even though he was probably sure she'd kill him. Tormund was great, and his ending scene was great too, and John just casually shooting him in the leg to shut him up. Pip was a little weak. I didn't really care that he died. Grin's death was awesome, but why take only 6 people into the tunnel and no arrows or spears? Very good point. One thing that's bothering me about Sam is that everyone, John, Aemon, others at the wall, talk openly about him and Gilly as being in love. Why doesn't anyone point out that it doesn't matter how much he loves her? He's literally a member of a monastic order of soldiers that can never have girlfriends. The conversation can just stop right there. It's not at all possible for them to stay together. There are no women in Castle Black, but as far as anyone in the show world knows, women are never, ever, ever going to live there. Another book spoiler problem I'm having is John going out to talk with Mance. In the book, John was under duress and expecting to die. I don't get the feeling that he expects to die in the show. He seems to think he's actually going to go kill Mance. But if that's the case, then why not bring his sword and ghost? Why would anyone even let him near Mance? Good question. Again, there was speculation in the show universe that John's going to go up under subterfuge, thinking that he's greeting, victorious Jon Snow has just taken over the wall and John's going to stab him in the back or something. Clearly, I don't think that's going to happen. But I'm also seriously curious on how he's going to talk himself out of this and kind of realign where we know these things are going in the book, which is kind of a uneasy piece forged between the Night's Watch and the Wildlings. Max G said, one of my favorite privileges of being a book reader is speculating on what book events will be put into each episode. Like you said in episode 9 Instant Cast, there's still a ton of major shit happening in Westeros that needs to be wrapped up in one episode. I think it's shaking up to be one of the most interesting season finales that Game of Thrones has had so far, and I'd like to hear your take on what will happen. Just for shits and giggles, here's my predictions. Tyrion escapes, shown in a 15-minute teaser for season 4. Dany chains up her dragons. Stannis saves the crow's asses. Bran finds the children of the forest. My ballsiest prediction is that Brienne meets up with the Hound and Arya. She bites off the Hound's ear, which she said in an interview, and Arya escapes to go to Braavos. This gives Brienne's arc a little bit more meaning. No Lady Stoneheart or Cold Hands. I think they'll leave that for when Brienne gets captured. Okay. I think Tyrion's escape is granted, and in fact, there is one scene where someone's pushing open a door, looks to the king's chambers, which I think is a POV shot at Tyrion doing just that. That was in this episode's preview, or episode 10 preview. Dany chaining up her dragons, you know, obviously that's going to happen. Stannis saves the crow's asses, obviously going to happen. Bran finds the children of the forest, obviously going to happen. In fact, I think that's the main reason why it's called The Children. And I think Brienne is not going to meet up the Hound and Arya, but you could be right. I think Arya is going to leave the Hound to die in this extra length episode, just pretty much like the book, where she doesn't give him mercy and she walks off. I think Brienne's going to be beset by some ne'er-do-wells on the road, and the Brotherhood of that Banner is going to break it up, and I think the last thing we're going to see is a Lady Stoneheart reveal. That's my prediction. I don't think Cold Hands is ever going to show up. I really don't think he's going to. If we're lucky, we'll get to see them battle their way to the Red Tree with the Whites, with, you know, Bran warging the Hodor, but I kind of feel like that maybe that won't be a non-issue, that they'll just waltz in to meet the last Greenseer, and that'll be that. There won't be any fight, or because they've kind of already done the whole warging in the Hodor. We know it can be done. We know they get in there. They don't have, it's an extra long, like 62-minute episode, but it's not that long for all the shit that they got to do. So it might just be, hey, just waltz right in there. Although, man, that's a lot of, I kind of worry with Jim what he's going to do when they hit him in the face with some of the supernatural stuff. Hit him in the face with a man growing into a tree. That's all going to be about visions and warging and all that. Plus Lady Stoneheart. Might be more than his little boy heart can handle. I don't know. We'll see. Janine S., a.k.a. the Dragon Walker. So I'm dreading episode 10 in so many ways. We could conceivably lose the Hound, Tywin, and who knows who else. Is there anyone worth following next season besides Arya and Tyrion? Number one, we don't lose the Hound. The Hound becomes a gravedigger. The gravedigger is coming back in a big way with the Clegane Bowl. Get hyped. That's number one. Number two, anyone worth following next season beside Arya and Tyrion? They're still going to have a bunch of cool stuff with Dany. You know, I mean, that was one of my problems with Feast. You still got Jaime probably being cool, going through the Riverlands and dealing with the Blackfish and all that. That's going to be interesting to look forward to. I'm actually super looking forward to Cersei's slide into delusions of grandeur. I think that's going to be massively entertaining. And I'm really looking forward to, you know, big key moments like the Militant Faith coming back. I'm looking forward to Qyburn's experimentation. I'm looking forward to, you know, how they're going to handle everything going on with the Krakens, with the Greyjoys, whether they're going to do the Kingsmoon or not, how they're going to introduce Euron and Victarion, whether they're going to do that at all, what's going to go on with Winterfell, with the Boltons taking in the Ghost of Winterfell. There's a lot of really cool stuff. Jon Snow dealing with all the aftermath of what's going to happen here and him being Lord Commander. A lot of stuff to root for if you really think about it. She goes on to mention, I'm beginning to suffer from death fatigue, and I'm a good book reader. The deaths of Pip and Grin were especially hard, as I thought that they were two of the few characters at the Wall we'd really gotten to know and care about. Now, save for Ed, why bother? Sure, Jon and Sam and Maester Aemon are interesting, but they can't carry more than a fairly short scene. I'm looking forward to the potential Stannis and Thorne. Who are you talking about? Tormund, maybe? and Tormund interacting, if that happens, otherwise, where do we go next? Like I said, I think I laid out some pretty compelling plot lines for next season, and we'll have to see whether the show delivers. I have faith that they will. It is going to be a big reset of people's expectations. You know, if you've been thinking that Tyrion's going to take over the Iron Throne, or that, you know, a Stark is going to sit on that Iron Throne, or that the White Walker is going to show up and crystallize everybody's ambitions, or that Dany's going to get her stuff together and sail for Westeros. If you're looking forward to any of that stuff happening, you're going to be disappointed. But there is a lot of other compelling stuff and new hopes appearing. The Sand Snakes, for example, which I'm about to talk about, and what all the intrigue with, are we going to meet Doran Martell? And, you know, what is their plan to avenge Prince Oberyn? And how are they going to introduce all their daughters and that whole family? And how much, you know, we're going to see what happens to Myrcella and what's been going on there with Aerys Oakheart and all that. Again, I think there's a lot of interesting stuff coming ahead. I just don't know there's two seasons worth of stuff. In fact, I'm scared that they're going to get into Winds of Winter next season. But I'm also hoping that we'll have the Winds of Winter by next spring. And that'll stave off the madness of, you know, book readers completely losing their shit for at least 2 years. And we'll see what happens. So, now, next tinfoil theory of the week. This one I'm really super excited about because this is another one that I read that made me think, oh, we need to do this as a segment on the podcast. It involves a fan favorite character and what he's been up to and some possible theories. And this is basically tinfoil regarding Jaqen H'ghar. Let's talk about what we know for sure about Jaqen H'ghar. We first meet him. He's imprisoned in King's Landing in the Black Cells, and he's with Rorge and Biter. They're two awful people. They're put in a wagon to be sent to Castle Black. They get fallen in by some Lannister guards who accidentally set the wagon on fire. Arya saves them from being burned to death by freeing them. He later meets Arya in Harrenhal, where he gives her three names that of men that he will kill in exchange, to balance the debt that he has to repay her for saving his life. He does all that, and at the end, once he helps Arya escape from Harrenhal, he magically transforms his face into the visage of a man with a hook nose, a scar upon his cheek, a gold tooth, and black curly hair. He gives her a Bravosi coin and an iron coin, and then tells her about Valar Morghulis and wishes her well, and then that's the last we see of him. Or is it? And the Feast for Crows prologue, we're introduced to a boy named Pate, which is a reference to a folk story about Pate the pig, and he's actually named after that character, and he hates that fact. He doesn't like anyone to remind him of it. But the boy's name's Pate, and he's a novice at Old Town. He's a novice, which means he's studying to be a maester. He's been there for several years, and he has yet to forge even one link. So he's kind of dim-witted, and he is lusting after a girl that cost a gold dragon to lay with. And to get that money, he's met up with this alchemist who says he can transform iron things into gold, but they have to be particular iron things. He instructs him to steal one of the Archmaester's key. It's an iron key that supposedly will open any door in the Citadel, which is where the maesters all stay. He meets with them later in the prologue, and he exchanges the key for a gold dragon. He has to see the alchemist's face. The alchemist is described as having a hook nose, a scar upon his cheek, a gold tooth, and black curly hair. This is an identical description to how we last saw Jaqen H'ghar look. As soon as he makes the exchange, Pate starts feeling faint, he starts feeling dizzy, and he passes out. Now, then, later on, like 45 chapters later, in one of Sam's chapters, he goes to Old Town, which is, you know, if you're a show watcher, not a book reader, shame on you, you shouldn't be here. But number two, you're probably pretty confused, because what the hell is Sam doing in Old Town? You'll have to find out. But Sam's in Old Town under instruction of the Jon Snow, because we need a replacement maester. Maester Aemon was getting pretty old. I actually fucked up and mentioned that he died in the cast proper. I had to go back and edit it out. But anyway, he's there to study. He's talking to some of his peers, And he's talking this mess about how Master Aemon sent him there, talking about dragons and talking about how he feels Dany is part of this prophecy that Rhaegar had. And they need to find out about dragons and then go counsel her and teach her and train her in these ways. And she finds this person whose name is Alaris, and he calls himself the Sphinx. And he's part of a group of Citadel acolytes who align. There's two kind of factions of maesters, the ones that seem to want to deny there's magic and stamp out magic in the world and promote reason over faith and magic. And then there's these kind of secretive group of maesters that all align with this guy named Marwyn, who's known as the Mage, who still studies these things, who studies magic and mystery, and who tries to light the dragon glass candles, and who are, you know, studying about dragons and ghosts and all the things that go bump in the night. So Alaris said, you're wasting time with these other guys. You need to meet with this guy. So he takes him to meet Marwyn the Mage. Marwyn has been mentioned by several unsavory characters at this point. In Essos, Miri Mazdur, she's the Magi, she's the witch that used blood magic to quote-unquote cure Khal Drogo, and largely people think was responsible for some part of, you know, Drogo being brought back as a brainless vegetable for Dany's a stillbirth, who turned into some kind of twisted monster, responsible for the birth of the dragon eggs or the hatching of the dragon eggs. She mentions that she learned about human anatomy from a maester named Marwyn. So there's one unsavory connection. Qyburn mentions to Jaime Lannister that he believes in the possibility of the ghosts, and he mentions that none of the maesters wanted to listen to him except for Marwyn. And he's the only one that gave any thought to the matter. So Qyburn is a admirer of this Marwyn. So these things might be somewhat bothersome to him. But the whole time Sam's telling him in this story about what Maester Aemon wanted him to do and about the dragons, Marwyn decides that he needs to do this. He needs to leave the Citadel. He needs to sail over to Slaver's Bay, and he needs to reach Daenerys and talk to her before any of the other gray sheep, which is he calls the other maesters, they get a bright idea to go over there and cause trouble. Because Marwyn, one of the other things he intimates is that the maesters are responsible for the death of the dragons in the first place through some unknown process. I say all this for two things. One, Pate, the pig boy, is sitting in the corner and listening to this entire conversation. And in fact, once Marwyn leaves, he escorts Sam to his quarters and says, "Hi, I'm Pig. I'm Pate, like the pig." Number one, no one, to my knowledge, has survived. No POV character from a prologue has ever survived. So I don't think Pate fainted. I think Pate died. More to the point, I think Pate was poisoned by the alchemist, who is Jaqen H'ghar. And I think Jaqen H'ghar stole this kid's face and is now parading around as Pate. My question is, why? What is Jaqen H'ghar doing in Westeros? Why did he come to the King's Landing? Why did he let himself be in prison? And I say let himself be in prison because there's no way a faceless man assassin would have gotten into a bar fight or murdered someone or did whatever and got caught and then made his way, found himself rotting the black cells without unable to escape. No fucking way. Does it have something to do with Arya? There's a lot of speculation, you know, if we want to go another level of tinfoil deep, that Cyril Forel was actually Jaqen H'ghar and that he was sent by the faceless men to recruit Arya basically and send her on a path that would lead her over to Braavos to take up and learn the faceless men's ways to some weird end. So he began her training, he protected her, he escaped somehow from the clutches of Meryn fucking Trant, which wouldn't be too tough, and Meryn Trant would just not say anything about it to save face. Hit, then found himself to be captured or put into black cells, arranged to be put into the same transport going to the wall as Arya did, put himself in a position where she could rescue him, helped her through Harrenhal, gave her the coin that's going to eventually lead her across the Narrow Sea into Braavos, and now he's over in Old Town doing God knows what. He is aligned with this Marwyn character, which is a pro-Danny, pro-dragon force. Another piece of tinfoil. There's the character that actually Sam introduces himself to and tells the story about the dragons. And he's like, whoa, 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 you need to stop talking about dragons and visions and prophecies and Dannys. You need to come see this Marwyn guy. This Alaris guy, his physical description matches a masculine version of one of the Sand Snakes, one of Oberyn's daughters, Sirella. She's an excellent archer, so is this guy. He's brilliant, and he's already forged 3 chains. This is very similar to, like, Oberyn. She's kind of described as similar to Oberyn's daughter. And the kicker, Alaris is Sirella spelled backwards. The Martells have a vested interest in supporting Dany because they had the secret marriage pact alliance that was going to marry off one of Prince Doran's daughter to Viserys. Viserys got himself killed, so then Doran's trying to pull the switcheroo and send Quentin over to marry Dany, which we know had disastrous consequences, but Sirella doesn't know that at the time of the story. So could she be sitting there to learn her links and maybe go over to help Dany with these dragons? What is the end game here? Where are the Faceless Men fit in? And are they over there to kill somebody? I mean, that's usually what the Faceless Men do, right? They don't just go on a missions willy-nilly. Someone pays them at great cost to perform a certain mission, and then they do it. What mission could possibly explain Jack and Hagar being over there for years, winding this very circuitous plot through Westeros, intersecting with Arya's lives, now intersecting with Sam, who's on a mission from another Stark, partial Targaryen? There's some thread here, but I just can't figure it out. I would love to know from you people if you've got some insight into this piece of tinfoil, how you think that, you know, is Syrio or was Syrio Jaqen? Is, you know, I think the Jaqen equals the alchemist is pretty plain on reading, although I didn't get it the first time through. Is he Pate? What is he doing with Marwyn? I'd appreciate any of that stuff. Send it into Game of Thrones at baldmove.com. Thank you for listening to another episode, another instance, another installment of the Spoiler Cast, another installment of our Tinfoil Theories. Can't wait to talk about more next week, and I will see you then.